Welcome back to Woolship Dust. I'm making faces as this tune goes on. A Silo season two has officially begun. Woo!
Woo!
Hi, I'm Alicia, and here celebrating with me for new listeners is Luke. Hi, Luke. How are you doing?
I'm very excited to get back into the world of the Silo. I've been really looking forward to this. Let's dive into it.
Well, I am, for anyone who doesn't know us yet, I'm a writer slash podcaster with a background in psychology, and Luke is an academic slash podcaster with a background in political history, so you can see why this show is catnip to us.
Yep.
And for those of you who are here for the first time and those of you who are coming back, welcome. We are very excited to have you with us this season as we think and theory craft our way through season two of Silo and Apple TV+. Measuring the characters we meet on the Juliet to Simsnard scale. And before I explain what that means to those who don't know, Luke, what's our spoiler policy to get that out of the way?
Yeah, so Alicia has read the books on which the TV series Silo is based. I have not. So the policy on spoilers is to try and preserve my book innocence to the greatest degree possible. So I am the fount of all ignorance when it comes to the book.
Representing the non-readers listening.
Yeah, exactly. I'm representing for the non-readers. And we will obviously be looking back at events in season one. So if you haven't watched season one of Silo, go away and do that now.
And episode one of season two. Yeah. And we're also going to, since we've already talked about it, we have two preview episodes for this season that you can check out. One talking about what was revealed at the Comic-Con panel, and another breaking down the first teaser that dropped. So if you haven't listened to those yet, then yeah, that's a great place to start. And we will be revealing some things that were discussed during that just make it easier to talk about this. For instance, the name of a particular character, and also the fact that there are two silos. You can tell that from this episode. The silo that Juliet comes from is Silo 18, which we know from the fact that that was on the hard drive last season, the fact that that was on that key fob that Bernard is carrying around. And what was revealed at Comic-Con, and is true in the books, of course, also, is that the silo next door that we see her break into this episode is Silo 17. So we're going to be referring to them as Silos 18 and 17 as we're breaking this down, just because that makes it a lot easier for us to talk about and a lot easier for you to follow. I'm also allowed to talk about anything from the books that has already played out on screen. So we'll get into similarities and differences with the books, but only if it doesn't spoil any of the story twists to come. I will keep my mouth shut about anything that happens in the books that hasn't yet happened in the show. If you're interested in that sort of discussion, you can find breakdowns of all the books and short stories, plus two book spoiler packed season one rewatch episodes, plus, as season two goes on, weekly extra spoiler casts in the book club. And I'll talk about that a bit more at the end of this episode. Now, Luke, I mentioned the Juliet to Simsnard scale. What does that mean for newbies, or to remind people?
So basically, that's our scale from goodest goodie to baddest baddie, basically. Juliet Nichols, the character played by Rebecca Ferguson, is at the goodest goodie end of the scale. And Bernard and Sims, Common and Tim Robbins, are on the bad guy end of that scale. And all the other characters are somewhere in between.
And our villain couple name for Sims and Bernard is Simsnard.
Simsnard, yeah. Because we just can't decide which one of them is the baddest baddie. So they both are. We came up with a portmanteau.
Yeah, we'll see where things land with them. And so just another little note, something that's changed this season is we are actually recording this ahead of time before the episodes have aired for everyone else, since we have screeners this season. And this means that we can get these episodes out in a more timely fashion as the season goes on. But that does mean that we cannot include feedback in the same episode as our breakdown like we did last season. So this season, we're going to do separate episodes for community feedback. And the more you send in, the sooner we'll do our first mailbag episode. You can send that feedback to woolshiftdustpodcast@gmail.com, and you'll find that link in the show notes.
I gotta say, I love the fact we've got screeners. I feel like such a big deal. It's so professional. It's just unbelievable. I'm really loving the screeners.
Well, just the fact that this show is airing through Christmas makes it so much easier. Mm-hmm. And yeah, just to put any minds at ease, just because we have screeners does not mean we are watching ahead. We've only seen the episode we're recording at the time we're recording it. Right, Luke?
Yes. Scout's honor and everything.
So you can trust all speculation that we make is genuine.
Yeah, we're not going to fake presscience. We're not faking omniscience.
Right. Yes, I'm keeping my mouth shut about book spoilers, but as we always say, that still leaves a lot of room for speculation because they make a lot of changes. But yeah, in general, we have not seen past what we're talking about. Okay, I think that's enough preamble. Shall we get into the breakdown itself?
Yeah, let's do it.
Your regularly scheduled breakdown will begin in 3, 2, 1.
We're here today to talk about season one, episode one, titled The Engineer. And this first released on Apple TV Plus on Friday, November 15th, 2024. The writer of this episode is Graham Yost, the showrunner himself. And he named this episode after his son, apparently, who is an engineer. But also, obviously, after Juliet engineering a bunch of shit all episode.
But I'm going to think of this episode as Juliet MacGyver's her way around Silo 17. There is an awful lot of A-Team-esque, MacGyver-esque inventing of stuff in this.
It's very Juliet.
Yeah, it's very Juliet.
The only person who MacGyvers harder than Juliet is Martha Walker.
Yeah.
The director of this episode, by the way, is Michael Dinner, who a very experienced director who's known for things like Justified, Sneaky Pete, a lot of thriller and crime stuff, it seems like. So, Luke, what were your overall thoughts on episode one?
I really liked it. I thought Rebecca Ferguson gives a really good performance. And we've said that a lot through season one of Silo, but it really does bear repeating because she has very few lines of dialogue in this episode. So the entire 75% of the episode is carried by her physical performance and building things and thinking about things. And Rebecca Ferguson has this really expressive face. So when you see Juliet trying to work stuff out, you can kind of follow from Rebecca Ferguson's face, what she's thinking, and what she's going to do next. We'll get to it when we get to it, but the ending, it ends on a real sort of cliffhanger, what's going to happen next.
Yes. First, there's literal cliffhanging, and then there's figurative cliffhanging.
Yeah, there's a lot of hanging, both literal and figurative, in this episode.
Do you feel like this episode gave you answers to questions you had going in?
Not really, but I wasn't expecting it to. And actually, I'll sort of flag them up as we get to them. But several more big questions occurred to me as a result of this episode. And I think I have more evidence for my tinfoil hat theory that all the silos are connected to one another.
Okay. All right. What is that evidence?
Well, where's the electricity for Silo 17 coming from?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Did this episode leave you eager to watch the next one?
Yes. We already know that the next one will be from Silo 18, Juliet's home silo. That was in the Comic-Con announcement. So I want to know what's going on with Simsnard. I want to know what's going on with Walker. I want to know what's going on with Daddy Dr. Nichols.
Lucas! What about Lucas? Allegedly sent to the mines. we better find out what happened to Patrick and Danny.
Yeah, we'll get... Well, I'm sure we'll get to Lucas eventually, Alicia. We'll get there.
Aren't you glad I didn't say George? No, I'm just kidding. I'm a Lucas girl. Okay, well, so let's talk through this episode. We will be talking through one arc at a time, which may be slightly out of order versus how it aired on TV. And the title sequence remains largely the same as the first season, or at least the version we have with our screeners. So please refer to our season one coverage for discussion of the themes and clues hidden in that. All right, we begin with the end of Silo 17. A boy whose name we learn is Timmy, played by Finn Gwagan, runs through a dark silo holding a torch, worry on his face. He rounds a corner to where a large group of adults are gathered, waiting, and is initially turned away because he is carrying light. But the kid, Timmy, talks his way in to deliver a note from engineering to his father, who is wearing a sheriff's badge. The note says, "Generator will flood in 15 minutes. Timmy's parents, played by Ross McCall and I think Kosha Engler is maybe the other one. I can't check IMDb because we're ahead of time, but based on the credits, I think that's who it might be. But anyway, his parents, they seem to be the leaders of this group, and they say they don't have a choice. So they ring 5 bells, their code for attack. Another group of adults, we'll call them Group B, some of whom seem to be wearing judicial riot gear, stand on the other side of a gap where part of the central staircase has been blown up. Group B is armed with shields and guns, trying to prevent the sheriff's group from getting past them and further up the stairs. But the sheriff's army is prepared, with metal bridges to cross the gaps and makeshift shields and weapons of their own, albeit those mere pipes and scraps. However, their sheer determination, their certainty that they are correct, wins the fight anyway. Timmy's dad is distraught to have accidentally thrown one of Group B's men off the stairs and thus to his death. But from his and his wife's perspective, Group B is following the wrong instructions by blocking them. Team Sheriff thinks that Group B believes the wrong truth. And so they hotwire the door to the silo open, and Timmy's dad grabs a green flag and leads them all, including Timmy, outside. So, Luke, when the episode started, were you confused that there was a bunch of strange faces?
Yeah, it's like I kind of knew what they were doing. It's like, let's start a new season and let's throw everybody off kilter a little bit. But I did like that when the kid was running with the message, you see him run past a poster with like "Thank the Founders" written across it, and then somebody had spray painted like "Truth Now" on it. So you could see that this conflict has been going on, has been brewing for some considerable time. And it's sort of Silo 17 was very nearly where Silo 18 was getting to.
Yeah.
At the end of season one. So it kind of made me think of the old line from Battlestar Galactica. You know, all of this has happened before and will happen
again.
Well,
wait, you mean Silo 18, Juliet's old silo, is very nearly where we saw Silo 17 at this
opening? No, sorry, Silo 17 is like, you know, a premonition of what's about to happen.
Oh, in Silo 18.
In Silo 17.
18 is where Juliet came from. 17 is the new one.
Yeah, I will get this right. I will get this right, listeners. By like episode 8, I will have this down pat. So, it just made me think of the, you know, there are interesting parallels here. Also, I couldn't figure out where I'd seen Ross McCall before. He seems to be one of those actors that's in everything,
face, yeah.
But he's never been a main character in anything. Yeah,
I feel like he's been like somebody's dad on TV shows I watch or something. But yeah, I definitely know his face.
Yeah.
So they had this note at the beginning. Timmy handed it to his dad that said the generator will flood. The power already seems to be out in their silo. What do you think that means, the generator will flood? Like with water or with...
Yeah, no, I assume that like there'd been some damage from the conflict that means that the groundwater is flooding the bottom of the silo. So it's flooding mechanical. Because basically the sheriff makes the point that they have no choice but to go outside. The silo is about to become unlivable. So one way or another, they have to leave the silo, almost regardless of what's going on outside, because they're going to die if they stay in the silo. They might survive if they go outside.
But indeed, as you brought up, if the generator is flooded, where is the power coming from?
Yeah. Telling you, they're all connected.
Do you have any thoughts on how these two groups got to this point where they're fighting one to get out and one to keep them in?
Well, in the next scene, we see somebody, a couple, refer to a guy called Russell.
Right. The couple is Timmy's parents.
And oh, okay.
They said, do you think Russell, who's, by the way, played by Nick Haverson, and that's who we saw leading what I called Group B, do you think Russell was lying? What about what, do you think?
Yeah, so...
And this is when the dad, McCall, which is face the actor that we both Ross McCall. Recognize, that he says, and if he was lying, we were all dead anyway. Yeah. So anyway, sorry, what are your thoughts?
So I wonder whether... Russell has been sent outside to clean, seen the virtual reality display of a nice green.
How would he get back in?
But that's the thing. If you like walk straight out the silo, see that, and then like dive straight back in.
How do you get back in though? Nobody's ever gotten back in.
Yeah, but there must be like a short period of time where the top of the silo is closing after you've gone out. If you like sort of do an Indiana Jones and dive back through the gap.
Okay. I have thoughts on that I cannot say because they haven't. I think they made this clear already by this point in the books. But it's not so simple.
Okay. Okay. So that doesn't work then.
Yeah, but if you think it's about the green programming, do you think it's possible they found it in a similar way to how Juliet and Allison and George found it?
Well, I'm tempted to say no, because if that happened, then my theory that all the silos are communicating with each other kind of goes out the window, because if that were the case, they would have made sure that error was not going to be repeated.
I mean, yeah, a lot of things to break down there. First of all, I just want to remind people who might not know what we mean about the green programming, because I know some people are hazy on season one, is that Allison helped George discover this program in this old software, and Juliet eventually got to see it along with some other people that shows that it is green outside, but when Juliet went outside, she saw this program showing it green, but then she realized she saw the same birds, V of birds, as in the video, and she realized it was just a loop, and it's fake, and obviously it's actually desolate out there, as we see in this episode. So, yeah. So they might have thought it was green out there and were rushing to it, and then instead they found wasteland.
Yeah.
But what else you were saying was about... Sorry, what did you say again?
Well, what I was saying is, if Allison and George found the old program in a way that is similar to what happened in Silo 17, then that
you
kind
said they
of
would tell people.
Pardon?
You said they would tell people, but how would they tell?
What I'm saying is, if that kind of leak happened in Silo 17, that kind of speaks against my idea that all the silos can communicate with each other. Because if that happened that way once, the heads of IT would get together and make sure it couldn't happen that way again.
Oh, I see what you mean.
Yeah.
I'm not going to say anything about your idea about them, the silos communicating with each other, but how, like, the heads of IT... would, like Bernard in Silo 18, would have loved to have stopped it, but it was beyond his power because it was just this hard drive that he didn't have. And, you know, he looked for it, and he even interrogated people for it. And poor, what's her face, Regina, George's ex.
Yeah.
She was kind of low-key tortured, and her mother was, like, put in the mines and things like that to force her to cooperate. So... he would have stopped it. And I think, yeah, that's he, but he's still only a human. He can't.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
Why do you think that the bridge was blown up?
Well, presumably that was like collateral damage to the conflict to like stop the insurgents being able to move between levels.
Mm-hmm.
So we don't know. We don't know whether it was Team A or Team B that did that, but it would kind of make sense from both sides to, if you can't defeat your opponent, then your next best outcome is stalemate. And if people can't move between levels, then the outcome is going to be stalemate.
I would guess that it was Team B, since the sheriff's group is the one who wanted to get across that and go up, and they built a bridge for it.
Yeah, I guess.
Who do you think Group B is? We see some, they're obviously much better equipped. We see people in riot gear.
Yeah, I mean, that to me, the riot gear says judicial. It says judicial. It says IT. It says, what were the people I can't remember. I'm blanking on the people that Sims commanded.
The janitor's closet.
Yeah, the janitors. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I wonder if Russell, who's not a character in the book, by the way, that's the flashbacks to what happened, happened differently in the book. We still haven't seen that part. But I wonder if Russell could be the Bernard of Silo 17, or was, obviously.
R.I.P. Yeah. Yeah.
So I'm wondering if this is, IT and judicial indeed, because they seem to be the ones in authority. But then it is funny. So the sheriff was downstairs, and it seems like he's teamed up with the Down Deepers. Like, is it always the Down Deepers who rebel?
Yeah, this is the thing. Like, I get that they want to establish that there are parallels between Silo 17 and Silo 18, but this may be a little bit on the nose.
Do you think that there's, so Jimmy's dad, or sorry, Timmy's dad, he grabbed a green flag to lead the people out. Do you think there's any meaning to the green flag other than allowing users to track which corpse is his?
I think it probably, it does track which corpse is his. I don't think we know at this point. We might get more flashbacks later on. We might get some explanation, but he did. That whole, sort of scene where they're charging across the bridge, that whole, he needed some martial music. It needed some, proper Les Mis style music. The whole thing looked very Les Mis to me. Yeah,
the flag thing was a Les Mis moment. I did wonder if it's, green, it's supposed to be green outside.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think practically it's just so viewers can track, oh.
Yeah. That person died. It all went horribly wrong.
Yeah. Do you think that the entire silo followed this group out? Or what about whatever remained of Group B, who we're assuming, if that's IT judicial?
That's an interesting question. That is an interesting question, and one I hadn't really thought about. Presumably because the lid of the silo is off, they're all going to get poisoned eventually anyway, or they're all going to drown.
Hmm. Well, the top few floors are open at least.
Yeah.
So relative to the present timeline with Juliet, how long ago do you think this happened?
That was something I thought about. I mean, the corpses are all very well decomposed. So it happened some time ago, although we don't know how toxic the air is and that outside, and that may have speeded the whole decomposition process up. But the bodies that Juliet finds hanging over the banister in the silo also look pretty gnarly. So I'm going to say at least a decade, probably.
And we meet a survivor named Solo at the end of this episode. How do you think he fits into this picture? And by the way, the name Solo isn't said in this episode, but it was revealed at Comic-Con, and it's just easier to talk about him with a name.
Yeah, I don't know. I'd kind of got the, in my head canon, I'd kind of thought of this as, if Team A, if the Sheriff's team were wrong, did they want to preserve some, did they want to having Noah's Ark that preserved some memory, some sort of living history of Silo 17? But why only preserve one person? Yeah, I really don't know what's going on with Solo.
Hmm.
I think that's one of the big mysteries this episode sets up for the season.
Yeah. I also think it would be unlikely that everyone would follow them out if people are trying to stop them.
Yeah. Yeah.
I do have to point out, book Easter egg, that the people in the silo are shown wearing different color-coded coveralls in the book. Everyone all the time wears coveralls color-coded for their jobs. So that was, they seem to be working more color-coded coveralls into this season.
I just thought that was to distinguish that we're in a different, I thought that was just one more signifier that we're in a different silo.
Hmm.
That we haven't switched back.
In the books in Silo 18, they wear that. We have seen people in Silo 18 wear that while they're working.
Yeah.
Like yellow seems to be maintenance. And we saw, for instance, Patrick wearing yellow coveralls while he was painting, things like that. So, but yeah, they seem to have been, there seems to be a few gifts for book people in here. All right. Do you have any other thoughts about that opening with the flashback?
No, I think that's it, except that Judicial and the Raiders and janitors don't seem to be putting up like much of a fight. Like they're clearly very heavily outnumbered, but they are the ones with the guns. So I think they probably just condensed that scene because they didn't want it to take
right
too long, but like
I did think, you get the idea.
Yeah, I did think this is a trifle too easy, to be honest.
Yeah. Maybe they were reluctant to kill, you know,
yeah,
their fellow Silosans.
Yeah, but I think it was just we need to condense this scene a little bit to get on to the rest of the episode. And that's fine.
Yeah, yeah. When you get, you know, as you said, the episode's only 45 minutes. Or I guess you said that off air, but yeah. That remains true. Okay, well, we're going to jump forward and talk about what Juliet is going through in the present moment right after a quick break.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
All right, so we cut to the present, and Juliet, played by Rebecca Ferguson, she's outside in the wasteland in her specially reinforced cleaning suit. She's walked out of the crater where the entrance to her silo, Silo 18, is tucked, and into the next crater over where Silo 17 is. And she has to wade through a sea of decaying corpses, a tattered green flag blowing in the breeze, crunching across their bodies, which have partially wedged open the outermost silo door. She wriggles inside, landing on piles of more bodies, some of whose meat is still clinging to the bones. She clears enough corpses that she can shut the door at the bottom of the ramp up to the outside, but she still needs to pry her way into the silo proper with makeshift weapons lying around where they dropped on the sheriff's army's way outside. She notices a tear in the heat tape sealing one of the wrists of her suit, and afraid that might have let in some of the toxic outside air, she goes tearing off to find a way to wash herself and to get her helmet off as she's also running out of oxygen. Running through the up-top cafeteria, she grabs a knife, a flashlight, and some canisters of soup that were lying around, and she runs down the stairs away from the top of the silo where the bad air has been let in, and then she uses these tools to bash open her helmet, which is stuck and running out of air, and she washes off her suit before cutting it off of her. So indeed, we saw that Timmy's father's corpse on the ground, identified by the green flag, and then nearby there was a woman cradling a child, so presumably his wife and son.
Yeah, I mean, can you imagine how horrific that would be for the citizens of Silo 17? You know, they fought the good fight to get out there in the world and see all this greenery, and like the first guy out, and it's like, oh crap!
Yeah.
oh no! And actually, there was an interesting little camera angle, because for a brief couple of frames, the camera goes so it's looking down on the crater of Silo 17. And actually, like, the corpses are really spread out. So, yeah.
They made a good run for it.
Yeah. A few people actually made it over the lip.
Yeah.
So.
They didn't waste time cleaning.
Yeah. It's not like everybody just dropped, the second they got out the silo. So I thought that was kind of interesting. I have to say, the sequence you described is the one moment in the episode that I thought there was a serious logic failure, and it took me out the episode for a couple of minutes, which is when Juliet is using that crowbar or whatever it is to smash open her helmet. She would have gotten a face full of glass. Like, she needed to do it, but she would have cut herself to ribbons, and you see her put the...
I don't know that the glass doesn't fly with that amount of velocity when it's that close to her face, but she could have bashed herself in the face with the crowbar.
Yeah, I'm going to say, if you do that, you're going to get a face full of glass.
So going back to what you just said a moment ago, would you declare this if we're going to call this a rebellion, what was going on with the sheriff's group, was it successful? Because they achieved their goal of getting outside, and they seemed to feel like they were going to die either way. So, yeah, did they, quote unquote, succeed even though they all died? And what would a successful rebellion in this world look like?
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. I don't think there is such a thing as a successful rebellion in this world, because what you're rebelling about will get you killed. And personally, if it was me, I would rather die with my illusions intact, to be honest.
Yeah.
Rather than sort of step out into the real world and go, oh, it turns out everything is crap.
But then suppose that they were right about them dying anyway, which I'm not convinced of at all, because, yeah, Solo's there. But if they stayed and they drowned, then they would have died thinking they hadn't tried. And to me, that would be worse.
Okay, I think we're just going to have to disagree to disagree here. Because, yeah, no, like... dying is one thing, but dying realizing the thing you fought for was a complete illusion. Like, yeah, I would rather die with my illusions intact, to be honest. Also, there's not much in this.
I always would rather know the truth. Always.
Okay. There's not much in this, but I think I would prefer to drown rather than
whatever happens outside.
Whatever happens out there, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, well, we see that, you know, Juliet has something on her arm, which I guess is supposed to be from the toxic air, and that is not looking pretty.
Yeah, no, that's nasty.
Yeah. But we also get in the sequence, we get an answer to the question from the trailer. She runs through the cafeteria in Silo 17 with lies written on the screen. So now we were wondering, is that Silo 17 or is it Silo 18 where things have gone
very
wrong?
And now we know.
It's 17, yeah. Yeah, so how long do you think the bodies have been laying there?
Like I say, the ones outside, it's hard to tell, because with the air being as toxic as it clearly is, that could have, like, really speeded up the decay. So, like I say, I think that we're looking at about 10 years, because the corpses that Juliet finds inside, the ones that are swinging off the banister, look pretty gnarly as well. So
yeah. Although, so I looked it up out of curiosity, and they said if bodies that are outside in ideal conditions for decay, which I would guess the toxic outside might be that they could be stripped bare within days.
I didn't need to know that, Alicia.
But when they're buried, then it can take like up to a decade. We do see when she falls in, some of them do have some meat clinging to the bones. I'm not saying that that means anything about the timing. I'm just pointing out that it's there.
Yeah.
So we'll find out more about the timing, I'm sure, as we go on. Now, okay. So I told you when we did our trailer breakdown that this is the most gnarly part of the book, perhaps, this whole sequence. So I'm going to go ahead and read the book version, which I do think is indeed just a little bit gnarlier. So anyone who thinks they can't stomach hearing about Juliet crawling across some corpses, just push the forward button a couple times. For the rest of you, this is an excerpt from Wool, the first book in the Silo series. And this is from part four of that book, chapter five of part four. Part four is called The Unraveling. The bodies were everywhere, covered in dust and dirt, suits worn down by the toxic eaters that lived in the winds. Juliet found herself stumbling over more and more of them. And then they were constant, a mass of boulders jumbled together. A few were in suits similar to her own, but most wore rags that had been eaten away into streamers. When the wind blew past her boots and across the bodies, strips of clothing waved like kelp in the down-deep's fish farms. Unable to pick her way around the mall, she found herself stepping over the remains, working her way closer and closer to the sensor tower, the bodies easily in the hundreds, possibly the thousands. These weren't people from her silo, she realized. However obvious, the sensation was startling. Other people. That they were dead did nothing to diminish the soul-shattering reality that people had lived so close and she had never known. Juliet had somehow crossed an uninhabitable void and had gone from one universe to another, was possibly the first to have ever done so. And here was a graveyard of foreign souls, of people just like her having lived and died in a world so similar and so near to her own. She made her way through dead bodies thick as crumbling rock, the forms becoming indistinguishable from one another. They were piled high in places, and she had to choose her path carefully. As she neared the ramp leading down to this other silo, she found herself needing to step on a body or two in order to pass. It looked as though they'd been trying to get away and had scampered over one another, creating their own small hills in a mad attempt to reach the real ones. But then, when she reached the ramp heading down, she saw a crush of bodies at the steel airlock door and realized they had been trying to get back in. She swam among them, waded where she had to. She stepped through broken and hollow bodies, kicked aside bones and tattered remains, and fought her way to the partly cracked doors. There was a figure there, frozen between its iron teeth, one arm in, one out, a scream trapped on a gray and withered face, two eye sockets empty and staring. Shown the way, she tugged the body out of the gap, her breathing loud in her helmet, her exhalations misting on the screen before her nose. Half the body pulled free, the other half collapsed inside the door. A mist of powdered flesh drifted down in between. Yum.
Yeah, that's jolly.
I think they did a good job representing that for TV, though. What do you
think? They did.
The most of this first part about her prying her way in, like using the tools on the door, you know, having trouble, especially in the inner door, this is like pretty much lifted straight from the page. So that's one of the places where they actually did that more, which I understand why. But yeah, one big book difference is this whole sequence. It's cutting back and forth between Silo 18 stuff at the same time. We do get cutting back and forth between flashbacks in this episode, but at the same time as this, you're also reading about what's going on at the same time with like Lucas and Martha and stuff. Well, it's not Martha in the book, but Walker. So yeah, that's a difference. Question about, she pours the soup on her. Do you think that was enough to get the bad air off her suit?
Well, she's only got, like you say, she's only got that one burn or welt or whatever you want to call it on her arm. So probably.
Yeah, I mean, I guess so. Yeah. This is one of the questions that I've been wondering most if they would portray this part. So I'm going to do one other reading from the book and from this sequence. And this is the version of the soup bath in the book.
Okay.
So this is also from Wool, part four, The Unraveling, but this is chapter eight. She was desperate enough to try anything. Juliet moved inside the walk-in, letting the door swing slowly shut behind her. She seized one of the large plastic containers, a bucket the size of the largest cooking pots, and tore the top off. The door clicked shut, returning her to her solid darkness. Juliet knelt beneath the shelf and tipped the massive bucket over her. She could feel the liquid soup splatter over her suit, crinkling it and splashing to the floor. Her knees slipped in the stuff. She felt for the next one and did the same, ran her fingers into the puddles and coated herself in it. There was no way of knowing if she was being crazy, if she was making things worse, or if any of it mattered. Her boot slipped, sending her flat on her back, her helmet cracking against the floor. Juliet lay there in a puddle of tepid soup, unable to see, her breath raspy and stale. The helmet had to come off. She fumbled for the latches, could barely feel them through her gloves. Her gloves were too thick. They were going to kill her. She rolled to her belly and crawled through the soup, her hands and knees slipping. She reached the door, gasping, and fumbled for the handle, found it, threw the door open. There was a rack of knives gleaming behind the counter. She lurched to her feet and grabbed one, held the blade in her thick mitts, and slumped to the floor, exhausted and dizzy. Turning the blade towards her own neck, Juliet groped for the latch. She slid the point along her collar until it caught in the crack of the button. Steadying herself, her arms shaking, she moved the knife and pressed in, shoving it toward her body against all physical revulsion at the act. There was a faint click, and her helmet popped off. Juliet's body took over for her, urging deep gulps of foul air. The stench was unbearable, but she couldn't stop gasping for more. Rotted food, biological decay, a tepid filth of stenches invaded her mouth, tongue, nose. She turned to the side and retched, but nothing came out. Her hands were still slippery with soup. Breathing was painful. She imagined a burning sensation in her skin, but it could have been her fevered state. She crawled away from the walk-in toward the cafeteria, out of the fog of rotting soup before she managed to gulp with air. So, yeah, I was a little disappointed in the show version of the soup bath, but they gave us a nod.
Yeah, they did. And I have to say, the book version of getting the helmet off makes more sense than the show version of getting the helmet off.
The show version is more dramatic. Yeah.
Yeah, that putting the chisel or whatever it was through the glass, that really bothered me, because you would just get a face full of glass.
Yeah, so I condensed the text that I read a little bit. So she does have to find like two things to get off the helmet, two like levers to click. But yeah, of course, there must be a way to get the helmet off, right?
Well, if you got it on, you must be able to get it off.
Right. it's a much more dramatic helmet reveal in the show, for sure. Helmet removal. Okay, so now Juliet is stripped down to a t-shirt and shorts, and the wrist that had been exposed is now bandaged, and Juliet explores the abandoned silo that looks so much like her own, but empty, dark, and overgrown with vines, cables, and wires draped across the ceiling going to who knows where. But she does find a yellow jumpsuit to put on in one of the empty homes, and then she notices a light somewhere. It seems some part of this silo has working electricity, and she finds a farm whose watering system and grow lights are still working, and she fills her canteen. And yeah, we also see her here. She breaks a mirror just to be sure, but yep, camera's hidden behind the mirrors in this one's as well.
Yep.
So as she's exploring the silo, we get this series of flashbacks. We're just going to talk about them all together, about her childhood with scrapping with Shirley and getting mechanical with Martha. So in the new silo is a dark mirror image of her own, triggering memories. Juliet thinks back to when she first moved down to mechanical when she was 13. This version is played by Amelie Childe-Villiers. I don't know if I should say Villiers.
Villiers, I think.
Yeah. She gets put on sorting duty in the scrapper's room, and so she's checking what's been sent down the chute to see if any of it can be saved or sent back to recycling or sent to Walker before the rest goes to the incinerator. And there, a young Shirley, played by Ida Brooke, takes her under her wing with the help of the scrapper sorting leader, Barney, played by Brian Bovall, and they teach her the ways of the scrappers and mechanical as a whole. And Shirley even invites Juliet to live with her and her father, which Juliet refuses. But after a heart-to-heart with her mentor, Martha Walker, played by Harriet Walters, Juliet realizes it might be nice to have a friend her own age. Juliet gives Shirley a toy that she'd saved and repaired, despite everyone telling her it wasn't a good use of her time. And though Shirley at first scoffs, she accepts it as the gesture of friendship that it is. And I was just thinking that it was also, wasn't it the same with the watch that, like, people are always telling Juliet, and the chair, also her mother's chair, people are always telling her, like, oh, don't bother trying to fix that. It's just a waste of time. And then she's like, gets double determined to fix it.
Yeah. I love that. There was a line in that scene that really made me laugh when Shirley's introducing Juliet to like all the other people on the recycling line. This is Juliet. She just moved down from the mids. I think she lost the bet.
Yeah.
And also, the guy that's sort of running the line. What, is she a criminal? No, she's not a criminal. No,
she's not a criminal. 13. I mean, I guess 13-year-olds can be criminals.
Yeah.
But I did like, I think she lost a bow or something.
That made, yeah, that, no, that was really funny.
Chuckle. Yeah.
And so to forge their bond, Shirley lets Juliet in on one more secret of Mechanical. She takes her down to show her the hidden entrance to the digger room and tells her a story of how she once fell asleep there when visiting with Knox and others. And they accidentally left her behind with no source of light. And she had to slowly feel her way back across the high, narrow beams to safety. So first of all, Knox left Shirley sleeping in, alone in the dark in this dangerous place. Now he's got even more splaining to do after.
Yeah, he's got some serious he's got some serious splaining to do. That's child abuse, Knox. That's child abuse.
I mean, to be fair, at that time he was also, we saw him last season, the younger Knox is also like in like 20 max, you know.
Yeah, he's at least 5 or 6 years older than Shirley. He should know better.
Yeah, but no, I'm saying people in their early 20s are irresponsible. Sorry.
Yeah.
To people in their early 20s. I do wonder, so Shirley is the one who showed the digger room to Juliet. Fine, that makes sense. But then we see Juliet and George having like very private times in there. So did everyone know that that was like their secret love nest and give them space, or did they just like had time to hear people if they came?
Well, again, in my head canon, I kind of assume that that's where people from Mechanical go to sort of make out. So
okay,
my guess is that like, you know, my guess is there is some like Mechanical version of a sock on the door. Mm-hmm. That you can, you know, the old sock on the door, tie over the door, right, kind of thing that you can do.
I mean, I guess
we'll get you let alone.
I guess you must be able to hear people coming because it's like a whole ordeal to get there. They have to like go through some tunnels and climb down this big ladder and go across the beams.
Yeah. Seems like a lot of effort for privacy. But then again,
yeah.
Where else are you private in the
right
day? Yeah.
I mean, yeah, well, I mean, why not? What else are you going to do with your free time? You might as well explore that place, right?
Exactly. But I did like the line Shirley has. Of course you could. What else are you going to go? What else are you going to do?
Yeah. Wait, we're going to talk about that in a minute.
Okay.
By the way, I want to give a shout out to, in the sorting part, to a minor side character we might never see again, Gladys, played by Pippa Winslow. And she's like, she's kind of a salty character who's dropping like all these warnings, like, it's hot in here, drink a lot, don't fall asleep on the belt or your hair will get caught in the rollers and you'll lose half your scalp. I'm like, that sounds like a personal experience that someone you know had.
Yeah. No, it's not just drink a lot, it's drink until your pee runs clear. It's like, right. Well, thank you for that. That's rather more anatomical than I needed.
Hey, that is good advice for everyone. So Shirley says Walker hates toys when she's like telling Juliet not to waste her time on that toy. Why do we think Walker hates toys? It's made me start to wonder, was there like, because we know she was married to that woman named Carla, who we met at the end of the last season, who works in supply. Was it possible they had a kid or something? Or was there a kid somehow involved? Why did they get divorced? Why does Walker hate toys?
Yeah, I think she had a child at some point. The other thing we find out in that scene is that Walker's agoraphobia has either been something that has come on since Juliet was a child or has gotten worse. Because she talks about the time she had pneumonia and she talks about stepping out into the corridor.
Well, I think that's meant, so we know that she hadn't left her workshop in 25 years. And I think that she does not count as leaving her workshop. She literally just like, but it shows, she just literally, you know, stuck her head out the door basically. But it shows how panicked she was in that moment. Just the idea of being alone.
Okay. I think that scene could have been slightly better written then because I got confused. I took it that she'd left the workshop.
Okay, I mean, yeah, she just said I stepped out and yelled down the hallway and then
I probably wasn't watching it closely enough, but okay.
Also, just want to point out, I don't know, Juliet's apparently staying with someone called Mrs. Weavers. I don't think that that's the same person as Gladys. And by the way, Apple, thank you for being like the only one to provide subtitles with screeners, but... But yeah, so I don't know. There's a Mrs. Weavers in play that might be a name we never hear again, but just pointing it out just in case.
Also, props to Apple as well, because they do audio description.
Right. Yeah, and they provide that also with screeners. Yeah.
Yeah.
And Walker gives Juliet a mysterious machine to fix. And this is something like we first see it on the conveyor belt and Juliet clocks it. It goes to Walker and then she gives it to Juliet to fix. And Juliet's like, what is it? And she's like, well, that's your first question. Do you have any thoughts on what it might be?
I was thinking some kind of radio. But no, not really. Not really. It looked very complicated, whatever it was.
Yeah, I do wonder. Yeah, I feel like they gave it sufficient attention that we might see that
again.
Yeah,
we might well come back to that.
Mm-hmm. And we also find during this conversation between Juliet and Walker that other kids have been avoiding Juliet since her mother's death. So I guess that also explains why she was eager to run away to somewhere new.
Yeah.
And Walker's like, we call a spade down here. Your mother killed herself. Like, damn, okay.
Yeah, that was really unnecessary. That was really unnecessary.
Yeah. And then, as you said, Martha had that fever dream once when she had pneumonia that she was in an empty silo, that she was alone, and she called it the worst feeling she has ever had. And so, of course, Juliet's thinking about that now while she's alone in this new silo, as far as she knows. Switching to Shirley, Shirley thinks that she says the graffiti in the digger room, she thinks it's from before the rebellion. So just clocking that. I wonder if we're ever going to see a flashback to the previous rebellion in 18. I hope so.
Yeah, maybe not this season, but I think eventually at some point the show is going to go there. It seems to be dropping enough breadcrumbs that it's going to go there eventually.
Yeah. And so, by the way, for this week's spoiler cast, I'm going to be talking about the rebellions in 17 that we saw a glimpse of and in 18 that we know of that happened, you know, before the start of the show, and comparing them and how they went differently. So I'll be getting deeper into that. I think both of the young Shirley and young Juliet actresses are great. They're very natural. And I love the chemistry
really
between them.
Good.
But also...
Particularly young Shirley. I really like young Shirley.
She has good comedic timing. I like her whole, like, Juliet asks her when she talks about being stranded in the digger room in the dark. Like, how did you get out? She says, I didn't. I stayed here for the rest of my life. Nailed it. But then she says, yeah, I went really, really slowly, but I found my way. And Juliet's like, I couldn't do that. And Shirley says, sure, you could have. What else are you going to do? Die? So I just noticed, like, if you think about what are these flashbacks about other than giving us more info about these characters, it seems to be about the two women in Juliet's life, other than her dearly deceased mother, of course. But these are the two women who seem to have made Juliet who she is today. And so these are the women who's she carries their words with her. And that's what helps her get through the most impossible moments like this one.
Yeah. And like, clearly, it's also showing you what Juliet's state of mind is in the present as well. You know,
Yeah. Yeah, and we see a nice transition, by the way, just calling out showing the two Juliet actresses have the same profile, the same nose.
Yeah. Again, one of my pet peeves is child actors that look nothing like the adult character they're portraying. And I think Silo has actually done a really good job with young Juliet of, yes, she could grow up into Rebecca Ferguson.
Yes, it's believable.
Yeah.
All right. Well, we're going to jump back to Juliet's present timeline and, you know, the rest of the MacGyvering that she does for the rest of this episode and that cliffhanger it ends on after a quick break. See you in a sec. So back in the present, Juliet continues to explore her new silo until she hears a sound from a couple levels below and sees another light on. She's determined to get to it and find out what made that noise. But the blasted bridge leaves a large gap between herself and her destination. She notices more corpses and riot gear strung up upside down above the missing bridge, so she goes up and pulls them up taking the rope that had been used to tie them up and creating a super rope for herself to swing across the gap. But the rope breaks, sending her falling through the silo, which, luckily for Juliet in this moment, is flooded. And she falls only a few levels before splashing into a giant pool of water, from which she is able to pull herself back onto the steps. She re-bandages her arm and puts on a fresh jumpsuit, trying to figure out what to try next. But first, she notices that the severed rope that caused her to fall isn't frayed. It looks like it's been cut with a knife. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, it looks like it's been cut with a knife. Yeah. So does that mean that the guy we see at the end is free to roam, is wandering around the silo? Is there somebody else? But my thoughts on the scene is, A, the people fighting to get out the silo, not necessarily the good guys. they may be right, but they're not necessarily the good guys.
But were they right?
Well, who knows? Yeah. Yeah, it's a good question. But yeah, just hanging judicial literally off the balcony. It's not a good look. It's not a good look, guys. Also, and this is like, this applies to the rest of the episode and the rest of the MacGyvering. Like, this must have been a nightmare episode to shoot from a health and safety and like protection of your performers point of view, because there's a lot of stunt work and a lot of things being put together and people falling over. And I was curious what's the stunt performer and what's Rebecca Ferguson in this episode? And, you know, how it was all done. Because, it's a very physical performance from Rebecca Ferguson. Not just in, like I said, the stuff I said before with her expressiveness, but there's a lot of running and falling and swimming. And, must have been a really demanding episode to shoot.
Yeah. And also in terms of like a lonely episode for Rebecca Ferguson to shoot.
Yeah.
It was giving me, by the way, Jedi Fallen Order flashbacks with the whole rope swinging thing. So anyone who's played that game, you know what I mean? But yeah, I guess, you know, we had the questions from the trailer. This is her falling in the water is clearly not the same scene we see in the trailer. But we know where the water is. I asked you where you thought the water was. Well, here's some water.
Yeah. Oh, you know, it's talking about computer games. You know, when you were a kid, did you used to play those like PC problem solving games like Monkey Island or Simon? Yeah. Or Simon the Sorcerer. And they came on like 19. They came on like discs that were stacked, like 19 discs to them, and you had to keep changing discs. That episode reminded me of those a little bit as well, you come to a clearing in the woods and the bridge is down and you have to find a way of rebuilding the bridge.
There are parts of it that reminded me of what's it called, the Monkey Kong games with the barrels rolling and stuff.
Yeah.
So when Juliet fell, were you surprised when she splashed into water?
No, because it happened so quickly. You don't really have time to be surprised.
Well, at first it's like, oh my God, she's falling, and then splash.
And also
because the water is like invisible because it's water.
And Rebecca Ferguson does this really cool thing of where she almost makes it to the other side of the bridge.
Right.
And she's scrabbling to stay on the bridge. And there's this like little scream / like exhalation of rage.
Yeah.
As she slides backwards, that communicates like so much.
Mm-hmm.
Just sheer frustration.
Yeah. Yeah. By the way, this falling while trying to, this whole getting across the bridge sequence and falling doesn't happen in the book. So, but I think that it makes sense as a way to establish the presence of this flooding.
Yeah.
And of course, she doesn't know how to swim because why would she? So she has to use some debris as like a paddleboard to get back to the steps.
Yeah, and then when she's on the steps, she just lets out this like really prolonged scream of pain and rage and frustration.
Well, we know she's afraid of water, and here we go. That's like ultimate immersion.
Yeah, and like just to get just to get a little bit real here for a second. Mm-hmm. There have been times when I've fallen out the wheelchair or the wheelchair has tipped over or stuff like that. And that is exactly the sound. I'm sure like everybody has these experiences. Mm-hmm. That is exactly the sound you make. It's halfway between pain and rage.
Right. Frustration.
Yeah, like it's not just physical pain. It's mm-hmm. just being annoyed at the situation and your helplessness in it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Although I do, the silver lining of this falling in the water thing is like, if the soup bath didn't work, maybe this helped.
But yeah, that probably would, yeah.
Again, her arm was looking bad. So, okay, so her next plan involves harvesting metal poles and fencing and plastic sheeting from the no longer in use scaffolding to build a makeshift bridge. And she creates a pulley system to raise the bridge and drop it into place to span the gap. But the bridge, which is basically tied together by strips of plastic, falls apart when she uses it and she starts to fall again. However, it got her far enough, and this time she's able to catch herself on the other edge on the far side of the gap and pull herself up. And I also say she has a safety rope tied to her waist. I think she would be an excellent adventure park guide.
She would. I've got to say, of all the bits of MacGyvering in this episode, that was the one that when she pulled into position went, oh, that's clever. I hadn't quite worked out what she was doing. It's like,
with the bridge?
Yeah, that makes sense. That's clever.
I think my favorite piece of MacGyvering is how she gets the other bridge into place. But
okay, we'll get to that in a minute.
Yeah. So on the other side, she sees wires run along the ceiling of a dingy but lit hall where office furniture has been stacked up as blockades. She's disappointed to find that the source of a persistent sound she hears is only an ID badge clinking against a rotating fan. She turns it off and continues to explore, finding the more sound bridge the sheriff's team from the opening flashback were able to make with their full set of tools. Because, yeah, when she's making that other bridge, she doesn't have like a welder or, you know, things like that.
Yeah.
So Juliet engineers that bridge back into place using barrels and sandbags and her own body weight. So the bridge spans the gap, giving her an easier way to cross. I loved how, first of all, just like her understanding of physics enough that she's like, okay, so I'll put it on the barrels and we're sacrificing these barrels. That's fine. They're going to roll off. But we need to balance this with the sandbags. And then she like rides it. Like that looks like so much fun. She hops on and rides it in place.
It did look like fun.
By the way, did you notice? Okay, so as she's walking through the halls the first time, there's writing on the walls. And I really tried to read it. It was difficult to read. But my best guess is it says like, what are you doing, run? I don't know if you noticed that.
No, I noticed there was writing. And I did try to read it, but
it was too hard.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, I couldn't do it.
All right. If any listeners feel like they have a better idea of what was written on the wall, please write in and let us know. So Juliet, she's wandering around these rooms, looking at all this office furniture stacked up. She didn't see the flashback that we saw, obviously. What do you think she's making of the situation? What do you think she thinks happened?
Well, I mean, it would be kind of obvious that there was some kind of a fight mm-hmm. with the corpses hanging. So I think it would sort of fall into place fairly quickly that there must have been some kind of rebellion here.
Okay. Yeah. And so then we get to the last part of the episode. As she crosses back over the newly restored bridge, the song Moon River starts to play a bit. but this song's coming back from the area she was just exploring, where, by the way, she did come across a door she couldn't open. So she follows the sound to a large, sealed, circular metal door, and a peephole slot slides open through which live human eyes are looking at her. This is a new character played by Steve Zahn, and he says, good. You heard the music. I love that song. So one thing, you tried to open the door. I get it. You know, you see a closed door. What's on the other side? You know, I understand. Thing is, you do that again and I'm going to kill you. And the peephole slams shut. Credits. Fin.
I love the way Steve Zahn delivers that line, because there's mm-hmm. no malice in it. Mm-mm. You know, there's no hate in it. There's no, you know, I understand you're trying to open the door. I'm glad you listened to Moon River, but I'm sorry. I'm just going to have to kill you if you try it again. Yeah. And the thing is, because it's delivered without any kind of malice, there is something even more disconcerting about the idea
right.
that this person will chilling. Just kill you. Doesn't want to. Just right. will.
Well, I wondered, like, did he start the song to call her back so he could say that to her? Or was he just happened to be listening to the song and she showed up? Because he must have heard her, like, you know, shuffling around trying to open the doors before.
Yeah. I mean, when I watched it, I just assumed that he was playing the song. But now that you mention it, yeah, that makes sense. Yeah.
So, any...
But then again, why would he summon her if he didn't want her to open the door?
To tell her? Or to warn her? Yeah, but now she knows there's a person in there. She probably would have just, like, I don't know, maybe... Yeah. I don't know. Would she have gone back there if not? Maybe at some point she would have heard that he was in there because he was going to eventually listen to music or whatever.
Yeah. Also, it's a good version of Moon River. And, you know, the Andy Williams, the definitive version of Moon River is probably much more expensive to buy the rights from. But if it's not the Andy Williams version of Moon River, then it's not the best version of Moon River.
Oh, for me, this is the definitive version.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
This is the version that I most often hear.
Okay.
I'm actually not sure who sings this version.
Okay. Because every time I hear Moon River, I just think of that scene in The Simpsons, in that episode where they rent the car and they go to, oh, I can't remember, but it's like Nelson, it turns out Nelson Muntz is the world's biggest Andy Williams fan.
Yeah. Wait, so this is the Audrey Hepburn version.
Oh, really?
From Breakfast at Tiffany's.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay. I think I do still prefer the Andy Williams.
Okay. I don't even know version. If I know the Andy. I'm opening this to listen to afterwards. I'm not familiar.
Okay.
So about Solo, one interesting thing they seem to have added for the show is that he has polychromatic eyes. You know, he has two different colored eyes. And you can tell, you know, I'm used to wearing contacts for cosplay, so I can see he's wearing contacts. So not that I've ever noticed Steve Zahn having polychromatic eyes before, but it's interesting. Why did they add that? So I'm wondering if that's maybe so we can clock this character at another point when they do a flashback.
Yeah, possibly. But I've got to ask, seeing as you bring it up, what do you cosplay as, Alicia?
Oh, I mean, all kinds of things. Like, I love, like, you know, Halloween dress up, like demons or possessed baby dolls or something. Or for fantasy fairs, you know, like various things, like a fairy or a character from a show or something, you know, character cool. from a book I love.
Yeah. Cool.
One other thing. Well, okay, sorry. Two other things I wanted to point out right outside the door that Solo is behind, because I feel like we're going to get stories about these later. One is that there's two bodies. The camera shows, you know, swerves to look at two bodies that are curled up on the ground together outside the floor there where they seem to have died. So I'm wondering if we're going to get a backstory about how those two bodies got there. And if that is, you know, sort of the warning from, you know, Solo's like, if you try it again, I'm going to kill you. Maybe that happened. And also we get a shot through an alcove full of blinking electronics. So it's not clear what kind of electronics, but yeah, there's a clear, the camera shows us, you know, shows right through this alcove that has a bunch of blinking electronics in it. So that's got to be important.
Well, I thought that was the Silo 17 version of, you know, Bernard's panopticon in Silo 18, you know, the room we see at the end of season one where they've got the people viewing all the cameras.
You mean
in the silo?
The where the janitor's closet is?
Yeah.
Well, first of all, well, I don't know if that's the same floor, but that looked very different. Like, this is just like an alcove, and that was a full room.
Yeah.
So this could be the equipment connected to that, but that I think that might be a different floor. I don't know. Things might be on different floors in this than they are in the book. So Actually, that is a question that Abby and I have. Like, how is this whole janitor's closet going to play into the story that we're going to get 17? But anyway, we'll see.
Okay.
So, yeah, if you, Luke, had done all that shit that Juliet did this episode to get to this door, and you find a person in a silo in which you thought there was none, but he issues this threat in this tone, what would you do next?
Well, I certainly wouldn't try and open the door again. but the first question that springs to mind is, why would you kill me if I tried to open the door? And I think Solo would answer it, because he's not, like I say, he's not being antagonistic. Mm. And actually, it seems to me that he'd quite like to have a conversation with Juliet. So my first question is, okay, I'm not going to try and open the door, but why will you kill me if I do try and open the door?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So where do you think at this point, and we're going to track as the season goes on, what you think, where do you think Solo falls on the Juliet to Simsnard scale?
Well, it's got to be close to the Simsnard end of the scale. I mean, he did just threaten to murder a person he's only just met. It might have been without malice, but he did just threaten to kill somebody.
Who knows what reasons he has?
Yeah. So I would say he's not full-blown Simsnard, but he's certainly sort of... If Simsnard is a 10, I would say he's a 7.5.
Okay. And so question, Timmy's dad, from the beginning of the episode, we saw he throws a guy off of this platform right outside where Juliet is, which, you know, he said it was an accident that he threw him off, but they were fighting murderously and obviously strung some people up. Where does that put Timmy's dad, Sheriff Timmy's dad, on
I need more information. I mean, I don't like the stringing up judicial, you know. The Geneva Convention should apply.
They've posted all over the silo, I'm sure.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, they should have got POW status. As for throwing the guy off the balcony, you're in the middle of a fight for your life. I can't really blame you too much for that. Yeah. I'm gonna go with a 6. Okay. So like, yeah, Juliet is a 1. Simsnard is a 10. Mm-hmm. This is a 6.
Okay. All right. Any other thoughts on this episode?
No, I'm really looking forward to getting back to Silo 18, though.
Yeah. So as you said, we know from Comic-Con that next week is going to be focused on 18, it sounds like. And then it sounds like after that, they're going to be, you know, switching back and forth within the episodes between the two.
I think this was a good way of sort of setting up season one, but season two. Mm-hmm. I think it's strange though, for all that I like Rebecca Ferguson's performance, I don't find Juliet the most compelling character in the show, even though she is the main character in the show. I'm much more invested in what happens to Sims and Bernard and Billings.
Yeah.
And Martha. I don't know what it is about Juliet's character. Because I think it's a very good performance from Rebecca Ferguson, but I don't find her the most compelling character in the show.
Maybe it's what you said about the plot armor, that you're not worried. Because I did actually, for this episode, like I said, it is a lot like the book, and I find that sequence in the book breathtaking, even on rereads. But in this show, I mean, in the book, I know she's not going to die either, especially because I've already freaking read the book, you know? So I know she makes it through this whole sequence of events and, you know, encounters Solo. Which, by the way, I in our Comic-Con breakdown episode, I read a passage about where she first meets Solo, the book version of what we see here, because that was a scene shown at Comic-Con. So if you're curious about that, that's in that episode. Yeah, but for this, when I was watching this, it was like, it's cool to show how the way her brain works. And there was, you know, there was tension, like when she almost makes it across and falls, like even me, I know she's not going to die in that moment, but I'm like, like, oh my God, what's going to happen? And, you know, and then the water splash. And I'm like, oh yeah, of course. Oh yeah. So that feels like another one where they're like, it seems like sometimes they give teases and mess with book readers. But yeah, I'm also eager to get back to the other silo. I am especially eager to find out what the deal is with Lucas. What storyline do you most hope gets picked up next week?
Like, you're just gonna be really disappointed if we get through the entirety of episode two and Lucas is just not mentioned.
I mean, I am prepared that there's a chance of that. I think that there's actually a strong chance of that. I can imagine them making that like an episode three reveal, what the deal is with him, you know, because they're just dealing with the general aftermath of Juliet going over the hill in Silo 18.
Yeah, I think this could be a very Sims Bernard-centric episode.
Right.
Yeah.
We got to check in with Billings, too.
Yeah. Actually, Billings is my favorite character in the show,
mm-hmm.
like by some distance.
So is that the storyline you're most eager to
have
picked up? Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Well, I'm very excited to watch this and to see how the season develops. And we're going to be back here every week, breaking down each episode week by week. So you can expect that to drop. These episodes will drop the same day that the episodes drop on Apple TV Plus. And then, you know, we'll let you know how it develops with doing mailbag episodes. The more mail you send, the more mailbag episodes we'll do. Luke, do you have any more thoughts before we do our closing?
No, let's do our closing and social and where people can find us and all that jazz.
Well, if you enjoyed listening to this episode and you feel like you got something out of it, the best ways that you can help us are to share this episode with other people who you think might be interested and to leave us a positive review wherever you're listening. It sounds like a small thing, but it really helps us enormously. So it's much appreciated. As I said, we also want to hear your thoughts and about the show and your theories, which we will discuss and post to the rest of the community in our extra mailbag episodes, which we'll do every few episodes, depending on how much feedback there is. The email address is willshiftuspodcast@gmail.com, and you'll find that link in the show notes. And please also join us on Discord. We have a dedicated forum for Silo with separate chats per episode and a book spoiler discussion as well. And Luke, I even saw you responded. Someone tagged you in Discord and you responded.
Yay. I'm sorry. Like, new season, new me, new season resolution. I am going to be more active on the Discord. I promise. I was very bad at that in season one. Self-improvement, Alicia. I'm going to be better.
Everyone needs to spend more time on Discord, more social media. Well, actually, I like the Lorehounds Discord because I do spend a lot of time there. By the way, you'll find me there, and I can get any messages to Luke as well. But I just—it's kind of like a safe haven from, you know, the toxicity of social media, of public social media, because this is like a place of like-minded people who are just nerding out about shows.
Yep.
No.
Yep.
And by the way, if you're sending in feedback, book spoilers are welcome by email or in the book spoiler chat, of course. But then that feedback will be discussed in the spoiler cast episodes, which will also be going out weekly with a topic linked to that week's episode. So as I said, this week's spoiler cast episode for subscribers is about the past rebellions in Silos 17 and 18, which are actually explained in full in the second book in the series. So that's a glimpse ahead. It's gonna be called A Tale of Two Rebellions, comparing what happened in Silo 18's past with Silo 17's and covering mostly material in the second Silo Book Shift. And Supercast and Patreon subscribers will also have access to breakdowns of the Silo books and short stories. We've gotten through them all now, and plus extra interviews with Hugh Howie with full book spoilers, and these weekly spoiler casts and show guides, extra show guides. There's also a new season pass option, which allows you to just get the Silo part of the book club for a one-time fee. So you can find all these links in the show notes, so you can check out what exactly is included in the different season pass options versus the full subscribers get all of that stuff, plus additional episodes like extra seasonal specials, like the we just had an episode going out for the connected to Witchtober, which is a look at what is a witch with a former professor of the history of witchcraft. Just looking at what is a witch in history, what does it mean to be a witch today, things like that. And also subscribers get additional Howie book breakdowns like Beacon 23, and there's going to be more coming up soon, and Dune book breakdowns, which will be coming up after Silo, in which case Luke and I are talking through the original Dune and eventually the second one on the public feed, but the prequel books by Brian Herbert and Kevin J. Anderson, Brian Herbert being Frank Herbert's son, I'm going to be covering those in the book club. So, and you'll find links in the show notes, more information about all of that. On the other feeds, starting right after this drops, David will be leading weekly breakdowns of Dune Prophecy on the Lorehounds feed, because that starts on November 17th. So we were going to cover it here, but we cannot do both at the same time. It's too much.
HBO, if you want to send us screeners for that.
Yeah.
just not because we're doing podcasts, but just because we're real cool people. That would be very much appreciated.
HBO and Disney are the worst for sharing screeners.
Well, fair enough. The people at Apple, on the other hand, are very generous. We like Apple.
We like Apple. Apple's our friend. Amazon's pretty good, too, in that regard. So, sorry, I was just recently bitching about their marketing. Or lack thereof. But anyway. So, yeah, the Lorehounds feed is the busiest feed on the network. Lots of stuff happening there all the time. The Star Wars Canon Timeline podcast, we are rolling through the High Republic again, re-rolling through in a flashback series. Radioactive Ramblings is currently talking about the Red Rising books in a Rambler's Rising series. Definitely check out Nevermind the Music if you haven't yet. It is a short and sweet and very deep and informative, nonetheless, music and psychology podcast. So it's the intersection of the two. Definitely recommend it. And Luke, tell them about It Can Be Said.
So my other podcast is It Could Be Said. I do that with Will Cooling and Simon Alvey, two of my friends from uni. We recorded our latest episode yesterday, looking at Kemi Badenoch's victory in the British Conservative leadership election, doing our preview of the American presidential election, which is exactly the same as everybody else's preview. We have no earthly idea what's about to happen, but it will be interesting to watch. And what else did we talk about? And a whole bunch of other stuff. So that's out on Apple Podcast. It's out on Spotify. We don't have a regular schedule. We just wait until there's enough for the three of us want to talk about, cogitate, and inwardly digest on. And you can find me at Luke Midup on Blue Sky. I am no longer on Twitter. I staged my own rebellion against Elon Musk, and I'm not hanging over a banister at the moment, so it's all going well so far.
Yeah, I am still on Twitter. I'm on Blue Sky and I'm on Threads. You'll find all those links in the show notes. Any final thoughts before we go?
No, I think I've said everything that I wanted to say.
I can squeeze more. No. Well, we'll be back in your ears for next week's episode 2 breakdown, even sooner for subscribers or season pass holders. And until then, we promise not to kill you for opening any doors. We'll be right back.
crossing you in style someday.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.